to go. Taco to
and a big queue.
Taco to go.
Taco to go. Trip Taco just $2.99. Comes with a big Q, this deal so fine. Brisket breakfast, so much to choose for $2.99. You really can't lose.
Taco to go, taco to.
This deal legit.
Taco to go, taco.
Only at Quick Trip.
Taco to go, taco to go, taco to go.
$2.99.
It is 6:13 on a beautiful Tuesday morning. 64 degrees outside, and we don't mean to belabor the point, but you better enjoy it. Because soon, the low temperature is going to be around 75. That's going to be the low temperature. We won't get close to 64 again until fall. So the hot weather's coming in. Highs today of 85, 87 tomorrow, 91 on Thursday. And then we're into the 90s, into the foreseeable future, barring like rain or something like that. So summertime's coming. I hope we enjoyed the spring that we had. We're going to talk about prescription drug prices now with David Howard, professor in health policy at Emory University. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Let's talk about what the president did yesterday with his executive order and how effective it's likely to be. And I guess we'll start with what exactly does his executive order call for?
Well, it directs the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert Kennedy, to try to negotiate lower drug prices with pharmaceutical companies. And if they're not satisfied with the agreement, then the administration will proceed with a regulation that says that the United States will not pay more than what than prices in other countries.
The United States being Medicare or Medicaid or American consumers, or is it vague?
Right. It's actually not specified. Mm-hmm. So it would probably apply to Medicare and Medicaid. Whether the federal government has that power to impose lower prices for private insurers is a little unclear.
He said the order is going to reduce drug prices 60, 70, 80, 90% and equalize drug prices globally. Talk about the inequity of drug prices, if you will, between the United States and other countries.
So in other countries, the government goes to drug makers and says, listen, we're going to refuse to cover your drug unless you give us a big discount. And in some cases, they've made good on that threat. There are drugs that are available in the United States but are not covered by government insurers in other countries. The issue there, though, is that if this order is imposed, one reaction drug makers could take, one strategy they could take, is instead of lowering prices in the United States, they could increase prices in other countries. And in some cases, just walk away from other countries because they make most of their money in the U.S., and they're not going to want to give that up.
Does this go to the healthcare delivery systems in each country where the United States is the outlier, and that provides the opportunity for the prescription drug, big pharma, if you will, to charge more?
Right. In most other countries, negotiations over drug prices are centralized. So in Germany, there's a single entity or agency that negotiates with pharmaceutical companies. They do an analysis where they say, how much better is this drug than existing products? Does it fill an unmet need? And based on that, they say, here's what we want to pay, and take it or leave it. And in the U.S., negotiations are done independently between drug manufacturers and a lot of independent, uncoordinated insurers.
So when you say they make most of their money from the United States, does that mean the United States, the people that pay for medicine in the United States, whether it's the government or private citizens or insurance companies, they're funding the research of these drug companies?
Yes, and so that's a concern, that if this, if as a result of this order, drug companies' profits go down a lot, there'll be fewer new medications, fewer drugs developed in the future.
So I understand the president had a ceremony and he signed an executive order, but what happens from here in the real world? Who is it that determines who negotiates prices over what? And when we talk about big pharma, who exactly is that? At some point, people have to get into a room. It comes down to people and deciding this kind of stuff. Walk me through that, David, if you can.
Sure. Well, the order is really vague, so it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. It could be that in a few months, Robert Kennedy announces deals with a couple of drug companies to cut prices that at the end of the day don't amount to a lot. They're a public relations victory. and we don't hear much more about it after that. Or it could be that negotiations fail, and then this order really kicks in so that the United States says, you know, drug companies can't give bigger discounts to other countries than they do in the U.S., and then drug companies are really going to have to decide, do they continue to sell drugs overseas, or do they just raise the prices so that they can maintain their profits in the U.S.? It's, again, the order is vague. It's really hard to predict, and this is kind of unprecedented.
One thing that got my attention, and I do take one of these weight loss drugs, and I've lost about 100 pounds, and I'm keeping it off. The official said that the order will not focus on a specific class of pharmaceuticals, but said the administration will look at the most costly medications and likely include weight loss drugs. And the president talked about Ozempic specifically and said that a common asthma drug costs almost $500 here in America, costs less than $40 in the United Kingdom. Weight loss drug Ozempic costs 10 times more in the U.S. than in the rest of the developed world. 10 times more. Why? What did we do, suckers, is what Trump said. So when it comes to these weight loss drugs, it does seem to me that, and you know, look, I have a horse in the race here, so full disclosure, I do take it, but it would seem to me, from the health of the nation and to forestall costs, this would be the cheapest thing that insurance companies could do is pay for this. But what kind of power does the president have or the government have when it comes to drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy and the others?
Sure. So right now, Medicare and Medicaid only cover those drugs for patients with diabetes, not just for general weight loss. And most insurers don't. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a little unclear how the government could just step in and dictate the prices for this drug when it's sold directly to consumers, not for weight loss, not for diabetes.
And see, that's the point, I guess, is that I'm just talking about my own case, okay? But I was certainly headed toward diabetes had I not started taking this medicine. So I guess they could have waited until I got diabetes and then paid for insulin as well as this medicine. It just seems to make every bit of sense when it comes to well care. But does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, these are incredible drugs. And it seems like every month there's a new headline about a study documenting potential benefits, including helping people quit or reduce their drinking. But, you know, we have to worry that if prices drop for these drugs, then pharmaceutical companies are going to worry about investing in new drugs. And there are potentially better, more effective GLP-1, that's the class of the weight loss drugs on the horizon. And if they're not able to make money on it, they're going to shift to other types of drugs, other types of investments where they will.
Let me take a break.
These drugs are... Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about the role of pharmacy benefits managers in all of this. Pharmacy benefit managers, because I understand they have a lot to do with this as well in terms of how much we pay for prescription medications. And is it just the United States government and the drug manufacturers, or is it the insurance companies and the pharmacy benefit managers? What role do they play in all of this? Because I guess, David, you can take us through drug pricing 101 and how drugs get to be the prices that they are. President saying he's going to lower prices by 60, 70, 80, 90%. I think that would be huge if he can do it. We'll see. David Howard, our guest, professor in health policy at Emory University, 621 Traffic Now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this beautiful Tuesday morning, talking to our friend David Howard, professor in health practice at Emory University, about the president. President Trump signed an executive order. He said the order is going to reduce drug prices in the U.S. by 60, 70, 80, 90%, equalize drug prices globally. One thing that he didn't mention, and I would like you to talk about, David, is the role of pharmacy benefit managers in all of this, because that's something that the United States has that other countries do not. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So these are companies, and most of them are owned by large insurers that negotiate and establish drug benefits. Mm-hmm. One of the things they do is to negotiate discounts off drug prices. And so when you hear that a drug is like X dollars in the United States and a lower price in another country, well, what they're quoting is the public price of the drug. But the actual price, the amount of money that the drug manufacturer receives, can often be lower if the drug is sold in an area where there's other drugs available. Those discounts, however, don't flow to the patients taking the drug. Instead, they're either retained by the insurer, passed on to consumers in the form of lower premiums. But the point being, like, drug prices are shrouded in secrecy. We don't really know the actual price of drugs after the rebates and discounts.
So does this order address any of that at all, or do you know?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, it could make drug pricing even less transparent, because there are also rebates and discounts in other countries negotiate. And so if U.S. prices are pegged to what other countries pay, that gives pharmaceutical manufacturers in those other countries an even greater incentive to keep their prices secret.
So where does DOGE factor into this with research and development and funding for new drugs, or big pharma getting money or universities to develop new drugs from the government or from their profits? Take me through that, if you would, David.
Sure. Well, DOGE laid off a number of FDA employees that reviewed drug applications. Mm-hmm. After that was announced, stock prices of drug manufacturers fell. The concern was that would delay approvals, and that would make it less profitable to develop new drugs. Of course, reductions in funding from the National Institutes of Health would also potentially impair drug development down the road, because a lot of the basic science done in universities then forms the basis of research and investigations by pharmaceutical companies into new drugs.
So I guess the question is, every action has a reaction. Is everybody pulling in the same direction here? Are we pulling against each other? What's going on?
Well, I guess it kind of depends. If you think new drugs are worthwhile and that we're getting a lot of bang for the buck, then the policies that have been adopted recently could potentially reduce development of new drugs. However, if you think they're kind of marginal and not that valuable and really expensive for what we're getting, then it could reduce healthcare spending. So there's kind of a trade-off there, and we have to decide, are new drugs worth it?
Is the president on the right path here when it comes to reducing drug prices? You study this for your life's work, or would you do something different?
No, I don't think he is. I think new drugs that are being developed recently, although there are plenty that are really costly and don't work all that well, on average, they're very effective. You mentioned the GLP-1 drugs that have really helped patients with diabetes and helped people lose weight. I'm worried that if we really cut drug spending, that we're going to get fewer drugs in the future and we'll be less healthy as a result.
Complicated stuff. Thank you, David. Appreciate your time. David Howard, professor in health policy at Emory University. Somebody texted and said Trump could give people $1 million each, and some would complain that it's in small bills. Well, yeah, but by the same token, Trump could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, as he said, and people would forgive him. And I just try to take the president, Trump, out of this, take any personality out of this, whether it's sports or whatever. Forget the personality. It's like when somebody asks you, you know, gives you a social scenario. Okay, A does this to B. Is C wrong or what? And it's different when they start filling in names, right? Then you look at it differently. So forget the names. Let's just look at the policy and see if it works or not. Talk to Tyler Bridges when we come back about car insurance and the legislature. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:45, let me fix this up. I said it was, I want my daddy's records back. I stand corrected. It was, I want my daddy's records, as far as the executive order and the flood insurance, but we'll revisit that later. Tyler Bridges joins us now, our friend, staff writer for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, author of several books. You can find him at tylerbridges.com. Full disclosure, I am a big Tyler Bridges fan. I think he's the consummate reporter and a great author. How you doing, Tyler?
Good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about what's going on with car insurance in the legislature, and I'm just going to turn the floor over to you, because you know where the skeletons are, you know where the lumps in the carpet are. Tell me what's going on with the car insurance and Louisiana and the legislature and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a perennial battle here in Baton Rouge before the state legislature. On one side, you have the trial lawyers who say that insurance rates are high because of greedy insurance companies. And on the other side, you have the insurance companies and their allies in the business community say that car insurance and other forms of insurance are high because the system is stacked in favor of trial lawyers winning big judgments, and that leads to higher rates. And this year, it's particularly active battle because of, you know, all your listeners know that they're paying high car insurance rates. And the question is, what's the best way to bring them down? And their constituents, the public, are putting a lot of pressure on legislators to find a solution. And so that's the big topic. And it's been happening here in Baton Rouge.
Who, I don't know, is it a clear one side or the other, or is it white hats, black hats, or are people now wearing gray hats? I'm trying to figure this out, Tyler.
Yeah, well, it really depends on your point of view. You talk to the trial lawyer side, and again, they will say that there have been laws passed over the years to bring down, to rein in their activities, and yet the insurance companies do not pass on the lower rates. You talk to the insurance companies, they say, well, anything that was passed didn't go far enough, and Louisiana is a, I think they call it a hellhole for business, and as a result, trial lawyers win too many big judgments that boost rates. So it really depends on your perspective. This year, the insurance industry is on the offensive. They have gotten a number of measures through the state house that are now going to be heard this morning before the Senate Judiciary A committee. The trial lawyers are fighting on defense, trying to keep the laws that they have in effect. But again, all of this affects your listeners because of the high in car insurance rates we pay.
So one thing that kind of got my attention, Tyler, is that from the beginning or at the beginning we heard, you know, why do we pay so much more than Texas does? Why do we pay so much more than Mississippi does? But to me, after learning more about this, it seems like a false comparison because so much is codified in Louisiana law that would have to be changed to put us on an equal footing of Texas and Mississippi, that's a false comparison. Am I on anything there or not?
Well, again, Tommy, it depends on your point of view. The insurance industry, with their allies in the business community, are saying that the laws are too permissive for trialers, you know, for personal injury lawyers, that they can win. It's too easy to file lawsuits and they win too much money. And people who were barely injured are getting big claims. The trial lawyers counter by saying, again, that the problem is that the insurance companies are greedy and they don't pass on the savings to lower rates for for the public. Again, this is all playing out in Baton Rouge. And again, as I said, the industry is on the offense and the trial lawyers are trying to fight back and prevent laws that will make it harder for them to sue on behalf of their clients. And there's also a big political element, Tommy, which is that the trial lawyers traditionally have been allied with the Democrats, but they gave a lot of money to Governor Jeff Landry when he was elected in 2023. And now Landry is in favor of a bill that the insurance industry really doesn't like. Insurance Commissioner Tim Temple doesn't like. The governor has said that if this bill passes, he'll blame. This bill would give the insurance commissioner greater authority to reject what are called excessive rate increases. The insurance commissioner says he already has the authority, has been using it. And if he has this authority, he would be able to act in arbitrary ways to not, you know, without showing hard numbers that the rate proposed was excessive. And he says if he had this authority, companies wouldn't want to invest here because then the insurance commissioner could act capriciously. The governor has sided with against the insurance companies on this one, against the commissioner, and that bill is going to be heard tomorrow in a standing committee. And the commissioner of administration, Temple, again, says that if it passes, the governor is planning to then blame the high car insurance rates and other kinds of insurance rates on the commissioner. The governor denies that. That's his motive. But the governor has indeed said a couple of times that he would blame Temple for the high insurance rates if this bill passes.
It just seems like, maybe if I can make an analogy, they've been saying it was initially kind of presented as, well, if, you know, if we paint the walls the color that Texas and Mississippi do, well, then we'll have lower insurance rates. But then what they didn't realize is, well, no, you'd have to go beyond that. You'd have to move walls around and build some walls where there aren't any and tear some down where they currently exist. And I think that's maybe the false comparison. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back. Tyler Bridges is our guest. If you got any questions, comments about car insurance in Louisiana, 504-260-1870. I don't see anything coming down, and we'll talk about the politics behind this insurance commissioner and governor thing as well. 652 traffic now, WWL. All right, 658, couple of minutes left with Tyler Bridges, staff writer, Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, author of several books. You can find him at tylerbridges.com. So let's talk about the underpinnings of the politics here with were Tim Temple and Jeff Landry ever aligned? Did they have a falling out? Is this all about making the insurance commissioner an appointed position and not an elected position? Tell me about all that, Tyler.
Yeah, I think philosophically, insurance commissioner Temple and Governor Landry are aligned politically. They're both conservatives, but the governor has veered away by allying on certain issues with the trial lawyers. And again, there's this big bill now before a Senate committee that Tim Temple's pointed the governor's own words to say if it passes, then the governor is going to be blaming Temple for the high insurance rates that we have in Louisiana. And that's perhaps an acknowledgement that it's very difficult to solve this problem, that maybe the rates are going to be with us for some period of time. You know, certainly high insurance rates are a problem throughout the country.
And meanwhile, back at the farm, there is a bill that's going to make or trying to make the insurance commissioner an appointed, not elected position, correct?
Yeah, and that's sponsored by Senator Royce Duplessis of New Orleans. He told me on Friday that 39 states have appointed insurance commissioner. Certainly the insurance commissioner takes in a lot of money during a campaign from the insurance industry. And the critics of Commissioner Temple say that he's beholden to the industry, and that's why he's offering bills favored by the industry that the trial bar does not like.
Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate your work as always. Tyler Bridges, staff writer, Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. We'll talk to Kirk Talbot. 713, nice day today, warmer than it was yesterday, but wait, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to be up to 90s by the end of the week, and from then on, it's going to be in the 90s until October, November, and whenever it turns cool for the first time. Kirk Talbot joins us now, Louisiana State Senator, to talk about what's going on in the session. How you doing, Senator Talbot?
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm all right. Tell me what's going on with car insurance.
A big day today. Judiciary Committee is meeting at 9:30. Bunch of House bills that came over, all dealing with, in one way or form or fashion, dealing with auto insurance, couple of Senate bills. So they're going to have a marathon meeting. And I feel good about them. I think most of them will pass. And we're really going to take a huge step in the right direction.
See, and I was saying this earlier, Kirk, it seems to me like that the narrative from the beginning was, and maybe it was just my misreading it, but was that if we do what Mississippi does, if we do what Texas does, well, then we can lower the rates. Why does Texas pay more than we do? Why does Mississippi pay more than we do? And it seemed as though all we have to do is paint the walls the color that Mississippi or Texas paints them, to use an analogy. Well, but it's more complicated than that because you actually would have to take some walls down and build some new ones before you paint them. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and you know, we, after last session, you know, we did some tort reform last year. We had a bill that got vetoed, and the Speaker and the President kind of tasked us with doing some off-session meetings, about four or five different committees that all touched this issue in one.
Trip Taco just $2.99. Comes with a big Q, this deal's so fine. Brisket breakfast, so much to choose. For $2.99, you really can't lose. Taco to go, taco to. This deal legit. Taco to go, taco. Only at Quick Trip. Taco to go, taco to go, taco to go. $2.99
to go. Way or another. And kind of said, you know, start over, look at everything. Let's see, you know, let's take that approach. And what we found is no shock here, is nothing in Louisiana makes us unique to where we should be the highest in the country. Unlike property insurance, where obviously we have a large coastline. We're subjected to hurricanes making landfall. We know we have challenges there. We have a large population that lives in coastal parishes. There's no reason why we should be the highest in the country. When you look around the other states, there's nothing that separates us from them other than certain things in our legal and litigation environment. So we started, you know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We can look at other states and see what they do and how that affects rates and how that affects litigation. And that's what we've done with these meetings in the off session. And now we're putting that in action in the form of legislation.
But there's got to be a reason why it's higher here, right? I mean, so there has to be.
I can tell you why.
Go ahead.
And it's, if you look at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners is the association of all the commissioners around the country, and they're kind of the gold standard on data, right? You know, they're a nonpartisan group. They collect data, they do studies, and that's what a lot of us look at to get all the numbers to see, you know, what makes us different in other ways. And if you look at, I think the last year they have available was 2022. If you look at our losses incurred versus claims incurred as far as bodily injury, what that means is auto wrecks with bodily injury. So just to give you an example, we have a state of 4.5 million people. We had in 2022, I believe, we had 65,000 automobile wrecks that involved a bodily injury claim. Take Alabama. They have 5 million people. They had 34,000 wrecks with bodily injury. Now, we insurance companies in Louisiana paid out $1 billion to settle those bodily injury claims. Alabama paid out $500 million. If you break that down per person, we're 2.5 times the national average. In other words, the accident frequency between us and Alabama is about the same. For every 100 cars on the road, you know, X amount get in a wreck. But for some reason in Louisiana with bodily injury, we're way more.
All right, well, let me drill
the amount of accidents with bodily injury in a state that has less population than our close neighbor, Alabama. We paid out $1 billion. They paid out $500 million. If, you know, insurance companies have to set their rate higher than that expense going out, or they don't make money. That's why our rates are high, is because of that.
So
and
let's
these
look.
Bills,
let's
I
look.
Believe they're going to take us into a giant step forward in handling that problem.
Let me look into that then. Are more people getting bodily injuries than injuries to their body in Louisiana than are Alabama? Or is there chicanery afoot? And does it go to, as Jim Donlin used to say, soft tissue damage, what you can prove, what you can't prove, a cottage industry
right.
of, take me down that road,
well,
if you would.
I think that's where the data has pointed us. I mean, we have the same body type as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we had more bodily injury accidents than the entire state of New York in 2022. That is our problem. Everybody sues, and everybody sues for bodily injury. And that is our problem. It's not that complicated what it is. It's a little complicated how to fix that. So, you know, like you were mentioning earlier, when you look at what other states do, you just look at what other states do. It's, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel here. You know, we can just look at our neighbors and see what they do. And look, I want to make something clear. No one wants to take away a victim's right to recover the amount of money to fix their vehicle and recover the amount of money to pay their medical bills. We're not doing that in any way, shape, or form. God forbid I might get, you know, somebody might hit me today and I might get hurt. I want my medical bills paid. I want my car paid. The damage to my vehicle paid. No one's taking that away, but obviously something, you know, we just don't have a system here that is working. I mean, we have people, you just can't afford auto insurance here. I mean, talk to friends and family. If they move here from out of state, it's sticker shock, and there's no reason why we should be that high,
Kirk,
compared to everyone else.
Let me take a break here. I don't know how old you are. If you remember, I watch old TV when I work out, and Sanford and Son was on the other day, and I'm watching an episode about Fred getting in an accident. He said he's got whiplash, and it rhymes with get cash, and I'm watching this show that was made, I think, in 1975, and it applies to what's going on in Louisiana today. And it really had me pulling what little hair I have left in my head out. So if that's the case, if people and look, it's no secret. You look at the lawyer commercials and they talk about, you know, like if you get hit in the back or whatever it is, if you get in an accident, here you go. You win a lotto. That's not what it's supposed to be at all. He got me $500,000 for my accident. That's not, you're supposed to be compensated for what damage you have. So when we come back, let's talk about how do you fix it? Okay, we have acknowledged that we're the whiplash capital of the world, right? So how do you go about fixing that? Kirk Talbot, our guest, will talk about it when we come back. 720 Traffic Now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Senator Kirk Talbot about the insurance mess in Louisiana with car insurance. So Kirk, we've already established Louisiana, agree, the whiplash capital of the world. You go that far?
We're certainly the bodily injury payout capital of the world.
All right, okay. So let's call it that. So how do you fix it?
So there's a number of bills that are going to be heard today. All House bills going to be heard in Senate Judiciary. We've got a loser pay bills. We've got bills on making medical bills admissible in court. We've got bills where, like right now, if you don't carry insurance, you can't collect on the first $15,000. We're moving that to $100,000. We have a modified comparative fault bill. We have some more transparency on medical bills going out there. There's a wide variety of legislation that's going through that committee today. We'll have a much better understanding after today on where we stand.
I will say this. I thought, you know, when I get the renewal from State Farm on the car insurance, I thought that was outrageous. But then I got the statement from the Fifth District about the equity, what do you call it, the where you withhold the money for the insurance, what do you call it?
The escrow account.
Escrow account, yeah. Then I really got outraged, but that's an argument for a different day. Let's talk about what reasonably can people look or expect out of this session when it comes to car insurance rates. What would a successful session look like to you, Kirk, in terms of results?
I mean, I think if we pass the bills that I mentioned, I think would be pretty significant. I mean, I think the last time we really had significant tort reform was 1996 when Mike Foster was governor. These bills, and look, these bills are not pie in the sky. You know, let's see if this works. And this is something, like I said earlier, we looked at in the off season. We looked at what other states are doing, and we looked at where they rank in insurance rates and also common sense, Tommy. You know, we look at, is it common sense that all the medical bills should be admissible in court so a jury can determine how much money we need to give someone? That's common sense. We don't have that now. And that's, you know, that's common sense. Modified comparative fault. Is it common sense that currently if someone is 95% at fault, they can still collect on the other 5%? That doesn't make sense to me. We got a bill that fixes that. So, you know, I'm proud of what we've done this year. We got a lot of different authors of bills. It's not just, you know, one or two people doing this like in the past. It's a wide swath of people, and the governor's very involved and the commissioner's very involved. So everybody's pulling towards the right direction.
Yeah, you're a businessman, a graduate of Ole Miss, by God, hotty toddy, however you guys say that. Tell me about when it comes to the insurance commissioner and the actuarial rates and what's being said about whether the bill about whether he can use actuarial rates,
sure,
to improve to give him an increase. Explain that to me, Kirk, if you would, please.
Sure. So there's a bill out there. It's House Bill 148. And what? Well, let me back up. So when a company wants to get an increase or a decrease in their property insurance rates or auto insurance rates, currently, and this is what the vast majority of commissioners, whether they're elected or appointed in the state, this is basically the process. Mm-hmm. A company says, I want a 5% increase in my property insurance. They go and they file that with the commissioner, and the commissioner has to run that through a bunch of actuarial tables and you know, guidelines that says, all right, show me your expenses. Show me why you say you need a 5% increase or a decrease, Tommy. And that's just as important, because we don't want fly-by-night property insurance companies coming in here, offering some cheap rate, And when we look at their, when the commissioner looks at their solvency rates and how much money they have in the bank, they'll never be able to pay a claim if they have a major hurricane. And we've gone through that before, right? We've had companies go belly up because they weren't financially sound. So it cuts both ways. But those actuarial guidelines are what determine whether you can grant a rate increase or grant a rate decrease. What this bill does is takes all that away and just says, Commissioner, it's up to you. And you don't want that. You want to use the data to guide you to do that. And, you know, that's what makes sense. And that's the old system is what put three commissioners in prison in a row. And we don't want to go back to that. We're working on a way to solve that issue. You know, maybe there's some things that we can do to get, you know, we want the commissioner to have all the tools he needs, and he really has them all now. But there's some discussions about that. But taking away all the actuarial guidelines I don't think is a good idea at all.
Thank you, Kirk. Appreciate your time as always. We'll talk to you again soon. We'll talk to Julie O'Donoghue when we come back about ethics. Right now, a minute late. Sorry, time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Julie O'Donoghue, senior writer at Louisiana Illuminator, a very talented reporter. You can follow her on X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it, at JSODONOGHUE. Hey, Julie, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. Let's talk about the session, specifically about some of the changes that are being made to ethics laws. And boy, talk about giving the fox more power to watch the hen house, huh?
Yeah, they're asking for a lot of changes, that's for sure.
Let's go through them if you can, please.
Yeah. Among the changes they're asking for are changes to what type of, they call them gifts, public servants can receive, and that includes elected officials, but also government employees of all kinds, so state employees and local employees too. Mm-hmm. Right now, outside of a few exceptions, you're not really supposed to give a public employee a gift. So, and that extends all the way down to, for example, dropping off cookies for your local librarian. Okay. There are a few exceptions for low-dollar gifts, for example, for public school teachers, from the families of their students and things like that. But one of the things they're looking at changing is allowing more gifts to be received by government employees and elected officials, up to $400 worth in a year. So there would be, you would be able to give a gift for any reason and any kind, $100 per event, they say, for a maximum of $200 a year. So that would be like giving a gift card to a health inspector or, you know, something to that extent. And then there's another prohibition that they're calling the king cake prohibition, although it's a little bit more flexible than that.
The
that would allow
it?
You to give.
The what? What was the
they're
word?
They're calling it the king cake provision.
King cake provision.
Yes. And that is that you would be allowed to give up to $200 worth of seasonal food to a government employee. So, for example, we'll use king cake as an example. If you wanted to drop a king cake off to, I don't know, your local school board office, mm-hmm. I'm not really sure, you would be able to do that. Of course, some public officials and government employees interact with many, many members of the public, and this isn't a $400 cap on what they can receive from everyone. It's from an individual or a business, right? So if you're an inspector of some kind, for example, you might, you know, interact with dozens of businesses a day. You know what I mean? So,
yes. So
the idea is that, you know, Governor Jeff Landry, an attorney that works for him on ethics issues, told me that he helped draft the bill, and he doesn't think that people's, their ethics or their moral code about doing their job is going to be compromised over $200 worth of food. That's his view. Some other people might see it a little bit differently. But, yeah, it opens that wide up.
Why?
In a lot of ways.
Why would they? What are they given any reason as to why? Because it just seems to me, Julie, with all the problems that the state is facing, making it easier for inspectors or public officials to get more gifts, that would seem to be a pretty low priority item. What, is there a reason given as to why this is important or got their attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there have been some ethics complaints to the ethics board about people receiving fairly what we would call like innocuous gifts, or at least I would call them innocuous. For example, giving your librarian some cupcakes for Librarian Appreciation Day. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Technically, that's not allowed, you know, and so they've gotten one, I would say, public employees and elected officials who are trying to provide or who are seeking ethics opinions like, can I accept this, right, from someone, and they're being told no. And I think some people think that's absurd, right? And in some cases, probably it seems a little bit far-fetched, right? So I think that's one side of it. And then I think in another case, some people are being, you know, chastised for this. Like someone complains to the ethics board about them accepting gifts. I do think that it is rather convenient because, of course, in some cases, I think most members of the public would reasonably not care about, you know, your teacher getting, you know, a fruit basket or whatever at the end of the year, right? But in other cases, people are going to care. Are you going to care if someone gives a law enforcement officer a $200 gift card when they get pulled over? Probably. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the origins of this. The ethics board has said that they get more questions about this type of issue than any other type of issue. What can you accept, if you're a government employee? And there have been other instances that have come up. For example, some legislators have brought up that they would like to give their administrative assistant or the person that's their legislative committee, you know, staff person, like tickets to an LSU game or a Saints game, and that's prohibited and that they find that frustrating. So I think that it does come up quite a bit. But this, again, this would be a pretty big change.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back because there are some changes I think they're trying to make to the ethics board as well. Julie O'Donoghue is our guest, senior writer at the Louisiana Illuminator, 752, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, talking to Julie O'Donoghue, senior writer at the Louisiana Illuminator, about some changes to some ethics laws, also about some gifts to public officials. And it's important to me because it seems as though if we're going to do all of these different things to make the area more business-friendly, the state more business-friendly to attract investment, then the last thing you want to do is give any type of impression that you got to grease this one or that one to get whatever it is that you need. Now, that's my opinion. Julie's a reporter. She doesn't have to go down that hole. But tell me what's going on with ethics board, Julie, and what they want to change and officials and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, so there are a couple other changes also happening with the ethics board. There were some changes last year. So the way that people get on the ethics board was changed last year. The governor and the legislators have more direct control over who's on the ethics board. But now they're looking at making changes to the process that the ethics board uses to investigate and charge people with violating the ethics code. Essentially, they're giving the person who might be accused of violating the ethics code a lot more tools to kind of push back on that, on the both the investigation. And if there are charges, it just makes it harder to charge. And it would be a little bit much to go into the details of that, mm-hmm. but they're making it a little bit harder for the ethics board to charge people. I'd also like to say they're loosening up some of the sort of the definitions of like what's considered reasonable travel that a interest group can accommodate you for. So right now, if I'm a person who wants to fly a public servant or an elected official around on my private plane to places, It's supposed to happen within the continental United States. And they are opening that up to also include the Caribbean. I believe Canada also is allowed right now. And it's allowed is the wrong word. It's sort of the standard for which you would then have to report it as like a contribution or in some other fashion. So they're loosening up some other kind of provisions in the ethics code as well.
Thank you, Julie. We're out of time. I appreciate it. And I don't know how that serves the public interest at all. I don't. All right, we got a relatively nicer day today than it's going to be tomorrow. Then it warms up and goes into the 90s by Thursday and stays there pretty much through the entire summertime. Hate to tell you that. I don't think we got any more cool fronts coming through. We're going to talk about food allergies with Alice Hoyt, a board-certified food allergist, because it's National Food Allergy Awareness Week. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing today? It is a beautiful day.
It is, but it's not going to stay that way forever. Are you here in New Orleans or not?
I am. I am. My practice is on Metairie Road.
Okay. So tell me, doctor, what it is that you do as a board-certified allergist.
Absolutely. So that means that I went to medical school, went to LSU in New Orleans, did residency at Tulane, and did an allergy and immunology fellowship, actually at the University of Virginia. And that means that I've done a lot of specialty training in how to identify what is causing a patient a problem regarding foods and then how to best treat it.
Do a lot of these go undetected?
That's a good question. Sometimes some types of food allergy disorders can go undetected, like what's called eosinophilic esophagitis, which is kind of like eczema of the esophagus. Other types of food allergies, like anaphylactic food allergies, they make their presence known. That's the classic, a little kiddo eats scrambled eggs and suddenly has hives and vomiting, or you've been tolerating shrimp all your life or crawfish and suddenly you're at that crawfish boil. And then you start having hives and swelling, and you're like, oh, no, what's going on? So those type of anaphylactic food allergies, those make themselves known, but there are some more indolent processes that we need to be looking out for.
So what is the first step that parents, you know, you got a baby, you bring them home from the hospital, I don't have any instructions. I don't know if you're a mom or not, but you know that. It's like, good luck to you. You went to medical school, so maybe that helps you a little bit. But how do you know? I mean, you don't want any kind of anaphylactic, and explain what that is, first of all, I guess, Doc.
Sure. So I am a mom. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Okay.
And now I will say that being a mom is very different preparation for taking care of children who are not yours as a doctor than med school. But you're right. They don't send these babies home with some sort of handbook. And really, we have over-medicalized how we feed babies. Moms and dads have a lot of really good intuition about how to feed their babies. Mm-hmm. And really, if we start introducing age-appropriate foods early, then we can actually prevent food allergies. So in kiddos who are actually at high risk of having food allergies, like kiddos who have eczema, like little babies, or if they've already developed an egg allergy, if we actually introduce peanut into their diet, like dilute peanut butter with breast milk or these peanut powders, then we can actually teach the immune system to tolerate the food so they don't develop the allergy.
Really?
It's much different. Yes, it's much different than that recommendation from 2000, year 2000, that said, oh, well, let's have kiddos avoid these foods. That was based on expert opinion, Tommy, not on evidence. Now we have multiple studies that very clearly demonstrate early introduction of foods. When I say early, I mean 3 to 4 months. That's not necessarily super early, though, for some kiddos. I mentioned I had a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. When my 5-year-old was a baby, she wanted nothing to do with foods until she was like 13 months old. She just wanted to nurse.
Mm-hmm.
My 2-year-old, he wanted to start eating my cheeseburgers when he was like 3 months old. So it's different kiddos are different, but really if we're trying to prevent food allergies, we want to encourage families to start introducing common allergens sooner rather than later. And those common allergens are peanuts, tree nuts, egg, milk, wheat, soy, fish, shellfish, and even sesame. And, of course, an age-appropriate form. So we're not giving babies actual nuts.
Yeah, it's best not to give, you know, the baby a boiled crab and a cracker or anything like that. You know, one of them
nutcrackers. Right, exactly. No choking hazards.
So how hard was it for you? I'm just asking a personal question here to separate being a doctor from being a mom. Because it's kind of like, you know, you got a lot of emotion there, and I know what it's like to be a new parent. I don't know what it's like to be a doctor, but I'm just always wanted to ask a doctor that.
It definitely takes separation, because you could go down a hole of like, well, I need to be my baby's doctor, mm-hmm. and you're already being your baby's parent, which mm-hmm. is hands down the biggest responsibility of my life, the hardest yet the most amazing job I have ever had and ever will have. And so it's been really important to me that I do have good doctors to work with for my children, so that I never, and my husband's also a doctor, mm-hmm. so that we don't feel like we have to be our children's doctors. And I have a lot of parents or doctors, and this is what we talk about a lot, is look, we're already being the parent. You need to be empowered with other doctors around you to take excellent care of your child. You can't put that upon yourself.
How old did you say your kids are?
A 5-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Oh, you have no idea. You have no idea. Hang on a second. just hang on. You have no idea what kind of wild ride that you're in. Somebody texted in and said, you'll get a kick out of this, Doc. They said, I'm allergic to prison food. I break out every time I eat it.
Ta-da.
Well,
I love it.
I tried to play it here, but didn't have it ready. Here we go. All right, there you go. All right, 821 more
Fantastic.
With Dr. Hoyt when we come back. If you have any questions, seriously, about food allergies, I'd like to hear from you on the Oakland Art Jeweler text me line at 504-260-1870. And what I want to talk more about when we come back is actually, I guess, Doc, you're saying do away with the or at least eliminating the allergy if you feed him a little bit of it at a time. We'll talk about that when we come back. Dr. Alice Hoyt, board-certified food allergist. It is Allergy Awareness Week. It is time for traffic now on WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Text line's going crazy here for Dr. Alice Hoyt, a board-certified food allergist. It's National Food Allergy Awareness Week. Somebody texted in, Doc, and wants to know, they said, some recommendations say not to start solid foods until 6 months. So should we start introducing allergens before that at 4 months, or is starting everything at 6 months okay?
That's a really great question. And when you look at the recommendation, you want to look at the organization from whom it's coming. So the American Academy of Pediatrics very clearly says 4 to 6 months. And one of the reasons they sort of hedge, and why the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, American Academy of College are more lenient to the 4 months, is because these organizations are focusing on children in developed countries who have access to clean water, as opposed to the World Health Organization, who very clearly says 6 months, nothing except nursing. So not even pumping formula, pumping breast milk, not formula until 6 months, because they're concerned about not having clean water and children getting sick from not having clean water to make formula with or wash bottles with. And so since there is very clear evidence to introduce foods early, that's why more and more pediatricians in developed countries, where we have food allergies, in the less developed countries, they don't have so much food allergies. But in developed countries, we need to start personalizing this approach to feeding babies and start feeding them earlier, just like we used to do.
You know, as you say that, it makes me...
Trip Taco, just $2.99. Comes with a big Q, this deal's so fine. Brisket breakfast, so much to choose. For $2.99, you really can't lose. Taco, 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 this deal legit. Taco, 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 only at Quick Trip. Taco to go, Taco to go, Taco to go, $2.99.
I realize, Doctor, how lucky we are. A lot of times we take a lot of things for granted. A lot of people were not lucky enough to be born where we were to have the advantages that we have, and we take it for granted and we don't realize it.
We are so blessed to live in this country.
Amen. Absolutely. Somebody wants to know about, let me combine a couple of texts here. Can food allergies be reversed or resolved in adults? Are there any allergies that kids never outgrow?
Yes and yes. So food allergies, we don't call it reversed. We say we can induce tolerance to foods, meaning we can use foods, like in someone who has a peanut allergy and use small amounts of food of peanut, like talk about a few milligrams. In one peanut, there's 300 milligrams of peanut protein. We can use 1 milligram, 2 milligrams to start teaching that immune system to grow tolerance to the food, so that then when they do eat the food, they don't have a severe allergic reaction or any allergic reaction at all. When it comes to kiddos and food allergies, about 80% of the time, kiddos with milk and egg allergies, those will self-resolve. But the numbers are flipped when it comes to peanut and tree nut allergies. Only 20 to 30% of the time are those allergies going to resolve if we don't intervene with that desensitization process, with introducing very small amounts under the strict supervision of an allergist, of introducing the small amounts of the allergen and increasing it over time.
Yeah, I want to clear that up before we go, and that is in terms of introducing food, and then you mentioned anaphylaxis. You certainly don't want to introduce anything just to see if your kid's allergic to or not. How do you walk that line, doctor?
So in babies, in whenever moms and dads see their pediatrician with their four-month-old, they should have a discussion about introducing foods. It's pretty atypical, very rare, for a child to have a severe allergic reaction at that age. And that's why we want to start introducing foods early, and that's why the recommendations are what they are. Now, if your child has a sibling who has a food allergy, or they already, we know they have an egg allergy, then you're definitely going to want to have more detailed guidance on how to introduce foods from your pediatrician or a board-certified allergist. But when it comes to introducing foods in babies, the earlier we do it, actually, the less likely they are to have a reaction. And that's why we want to introduce it and incorporate it. So not just giving it to them once and being like, okay, they're not allergic, but actually get it into their diet as part of their diet. If they already have an allergy, then they're going to be want to be under the care of a board-certified allergist so that they can have options about, do we do the oral immunotherapy? Do we avoid right now and see if it's going to resolve on its own?
Doc, we're out of time. I want you to come back on, okay? Because it's some very valuable information. The audience loves you, and I love you, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Thanks so much. You have a great day.
You too. Dr. Alice Hoyt, board certified food allergist. We'll talk to Representative Matthew Willard when we come back, see what he's got going on in Baton Rouge. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about the legislative session, joined now by Representative Matthew Willard, like myself, a proud graduate of UNO. How you doing, Matt?
Hey, Tommy, good morning. How you doing?
I got to ask you a question real quick about your bio here. I'm seeing that you are a Influence Analytics?
Yeah.
What is that?
So it was a startup company that started in the physics department on Tulane's campus. We were acquired by one of our investors, Yokogawa Electric Corporation. So now we're Yokogawa Fluence Analytics. But I'm the marketing director over there.
Oh, okay.
We make real-time analytics equipment for the chemicals and the biopharmaceutical industries.
Everybody's got a story, Matt. I just wanted to hear yours. Tell me what's got your some of the bills that you've sponsored in this session. What's got your attention?
Well, I think one that is probably most interesting to the people in the greater New Orleans area is I have a bill to increase the homestead exemption. The way it's structured, if it passes statewide and through the legislature, local governing authorities, so your parish city councils, would be able to increase the homestead exemption for their residents up to $125,000. So that's probably the bill that is most interesting to the people of the city of New Orleans and in Jefferson Parish. We know property taxes are increasing. We know that insurance costs continue to rise. And so this would provide some relief to the rest in the greater New Orleans area.
So what made you do this? And why? How is that going to be different than it is now?
Affordability has always been a focus of mine. Actually, during my first session back in 2020, I ran a constitutional amendment to provide property tax relief to the people of New Orleans. It was a statewide constitutional amendment, which is tricky to pass something when it only deals with the city of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It failed by about 7,000 votes. I started looking into more options. The homestead exemption was created in the 70s, last increased in 1980 to its current level of $75,000. If you tie that to inflation, I mean, we're way behind here. Back when it was created, it essentially covered the majority of property taxes that homeowners had to pay. And so I think it's by time that we increase that. My increase would not keep up with inflation, but it balances the books. It allows local governments to decide, number one, do they want to provide that relief to their homeowners? And number two, if they do, how much can they afford to actually do? And so my bill would just allow city councils to increase the homestead exemption up to $125,000. If they wanted to go to $100,000, they could. If they wanted to go to $85,000, they could.
So I'm reading from an Illuminator article here written by Brooke Thorington.
Yep.
So I'm getting my source straight here. But critics of the bill, like Representative Michael Eccles, Republican from Monroe, said the proposal is too expensive and could force cuts to other areas of government. So I'm confused because at one point I thought Democrats were for taxes and Republicans were against taxes. Now it seems as though you're a Democrat and you're against taxes and the Republicans saying, no, keep the taxes on the system. Is that what I'm seeing here or not?
Yeah, well, there are very strange times happening in the Louisiana legislature, mm-hmm. Tommy. But I really do think that my colleague, Rep. Eccles, had his talk points prepared before I introduced the amendment, which would allow local government to approve the increase. Initially, when I filed it, it was just to increase the homestead exemption across the board. I knew that some local governments, number one, didn't need to do that because their property tax, their property values aren't as high when you look at, you know, parishes like Orleans, Jefferson, St. Tammany. So I think that was the big thing. And then the other thing is, if a local government truly can't afford to do it, they don't have to do it. So if this amendment passes, nothing changes unless a local government says, hey, we have people leaving our parish. We need to provide them some relief. We need to make sure that they can afford to live in our parish. So we're going to go ahead and come up with a plan to increase that homestead exemption and make it easier for them to live in our parish.
I'm going to pick your brain when we come back, because the thing I've been on this week, it seems as though, Matt, is, you know, if I were to give you a scenario and say, person A tells person B this, and then person C decides this, and it's a guy and a girl or a girl and whatever it is, and I give you the scenario, you're liable to give me a set, not you personally, but the generic you is liable to give me an evaluation of the situation, right? But then if I change it and make it about friends and make it personal, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, hang on a second, you didn't tell me that. And I want to talk to you about that vis-a-vis the Republican and the Democrat thing, because it seems like if it comes from a Democrat or a Republican, it's bad, or if it comes from a Democrat or a Republican, it's good. And what gets lost in all of that is, well, let's just talk about the proposal itself and the consequences, both intended and unintended. We'll pick it up when we come back. 851 traffic now, WWL. 8:57 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Matthew Willard, who is head of the Democratic caucus in Baton Rouge. Is that right, Matt?
That's correct.
Yeah, state representative. And I was asking you before the break, and I've been on this thing this week where if I tell you, okay, a girl and a guy are going out and a girl does this and a guy does that, and I ask you if you're an analysis of the situation, you might tell me one thing. But then if I make it about friends that we all know, then maybe you might look at it differently. And it seems to me we have so much of that in politics now where forget who said what or who it's about. Is it the right or wrong thing to do? Is the policy good or bad for the most people? How partisan is it in Baton Rouge right now?
Baton Rouge is nowhere close to what Washington, D.C. is like. Okay. It's very partisan still, but we still can work together. I was talking to somebody yesterday. I view my job as one of objectivity. I look at a proposal. I don't look at the author. I try not to look at their party affiliation and make a determination. Is this good for the people and the businesses of the state of Louisiana? If it is, I can support it. If it's not, I have to oppose it. And I think we would be better served if we had more legislators who approached the job that way.
Maybe it'd be better if it was introduced as you say that. I'm thinking, you know, some kind of blind thing, whereas no R, no D, no nothing. You just submit the bill and then look at it on its own merits. But I know that'll never happen. Let's talk about, I know you're on the House Insurance Committee. What hope can you give me or anybody that something's going to turn out with either homeowners insurance or house or a car insurance is going to be beneficial to us?
I think there will be significant changes. There are some proposals that would provide relief to homeowners and vehicle owners in the state of Louisiana. But at the end of the day, I don't want to promise anything. And there's a lot of controversial proposals right now, kind of pitting the governor against the insurance commissioner. A lot of those bills are headed to the Senate, and you've been hearing about a lot of those related to tort reform. There's a couple of good policy proposals on the homeowners insurance side. So we'll see. We're at the halfway point of session right now. So I'm hopeful that when we walk away, the people of Louisiana get some relief.
All right, Matt. Thank you. I appreciate your time. Matthew Willard, Louisiana State Representative. We're going to talk Pelicans when we come back. Then we'll talk about loneliness and AI. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Stay with us. A lot coming up. WWL. And into the 9 o'clock hour we go. We're going to talk to Dr. Judy Ho in the second half, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Mark Zuckerberg said AI is going to fill the need for human friends. So I would ask you at 504-260-1870, really? Can you ever replace the benefits of having human-human interaction with AI? By knowing that, because to me, you got to suspend your disbelief. And it's the same as, you know, men that see people that, you know, or women, whatever, that are professionals in the love business. And I'll phrase that politely, because what fun is it if you know they're just there because you're paying them? And it's the same thing to me with AI. If you know there's no real person that's reacting to what you're saying, how could you even like that? But we'll talk about that in the second half of the hour. Right now, we're drawing.
Taco just $2.99. Comes with a big Q, this deal's so fine. Brisket breakfast, so much to choose. For $2.99, you really can't lose. Taco, 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 taco. This deal legit. Taco, taco, taco. Only at Quick Trip. Taco to go, taco to go, taco to go. $2.99.
Joined by Jake Madison, host of Locked On Pelicans, to talk about this NBA draft lottery. How you doing, Jake?
I'm doing well, better than the Pelicans certainly are today after the way last night went.
Let me just ask you beforehand, because we were talking about it yesterday, and the whole process, it seems kind of convoluted and secretive when it doesn't have to be. Talk about the process first, if you will, Jake, for people that are just casual followers and don't quite understand what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's a literal lottery. They do about 1,000 ping pong ball combinations, and they divvy them up between the teams that don't make the playoffs in kind of a locked back room where each team has a representative in there. A new executive vice president of basketball operations, Joe Dumars, was in that room for the Pelicans last night. It's audited by Ernst & Young, so one of the big accounting companies, and they literally drop ping pong balls. And when those four balls come up, they, you know, it matches a combination of a team, and that's how they draw just for the top four picks. So this isn't for the entirety of the draft. It's just a lottery for the top four picks weighted towards the teams with the worst record. And so you get these kind of outlier situations on occasion. It statistically can happen where a team with, I think it was a 1.8% chance in the Dallas Mavericks, jumps up to the number one overall pick, jumping up 10 spots. That leads them to getting kind of a generational type of prospect.
There's not a more equitable way to do this?
You know, the league has done it in the past. You know, this is going back to the 80s, where it was just the team with the worst record gets the number one overall pick, second worst record gets the second overall pick. You know, you have an issue then with tanking in the NBA, with teams intentionally trying to lose to improve their draft stock here. And that is just not a situation anyone wants. If you look at the Pelicans and the attendance in the Smoothie King Center at the end of the season, it was pretty light, knowing that there really just wasn't much to play for. And so you want these teams to try and be as competitive as possible. So they instituted the lottery to try and dissuade some of that. That still happened. Teams were still tanking because you may as well improve the odds a little bit if it means losing one or two more games. So in recent years, they've flattened the lottery odds where they've made it a little bit, you know, not as weighted towards the top teams and maybe a little bit more equitable for 1 through 14, which is kind of what you're looking at here. And that leads to, you know, the team with the worst record not getting the top overall pick, I think, for 5 years in a row right now. So it's been a little while, and it can lead to kind of crazy outcomes like what we saw last night. But the league wants teams trying. They want them trying to win. That's what fans are paying to go and see. That's why they have the lottery with the odds the way it is. That's even why they have the play-in tournament, where teams in the 9 and 10th spot can have a chance to make the postseason. So it gives teams more of an incentive to try and compete and win games.
Maybe I'm just jaded because the Pelican season seems to have ended so early this year, but either way, what happens from here? What are the Pelicans, where do the Pelicans stand, and what are they looking at doing?
Yeah, you know, they had about a nightmare scenario last night. You can fall up to four spots in the draft lottery from where you were slotted, and the Pelicans were slotted for fourth, and they ended up falling down three spots to the seventh spot. And this is really a two-person draft. And to make it even worse, the team that got the number one overall pick, the Dallas Mavericks, and the team that got the second pick, the San Antonio Spurs, those are going to be very, very good teams next year, and they were decent enough teams this year, nearly winning 40 games. So to see two division rival teams the Pelicans are going to have to play four times every year going forward, get these top picks, is, I think, a very frustrating situation. But the good news is this is a pretty stacked draft. This is a draft where you're going to have multiple guys come out of that top 10 and be really good NBA players. And so even if the Pelicans miss out on Cooper Flagg, who's going to be the number one overall pick, or Dylan Harper, the point guard from Rutgers, who's likely going to be number two, they're still in position to get a guy that's going to make an impact, not just next year, but really for the next 10 years, hopefully. Whether that's a guy like Konkanipel out of Duke, a small forward who's going to be an excellent three-point shooter at the NBA level. There's Jeremiah Fears there, the point guard from Oklahoma, that reminds you a little bit of guys like Jamal Murray and other NBA champions at this level. So they're in position to be able to draft someone really well that's going to hopefully get them back into the playoffs next season.
When it comes to trades or moving up with a pick, any way the Pelicans could do that, or would that something they would want to do that?
You know, I think the most likely scenario, and it's still a bit of a long shot, would be trying to trade for the second overall pick with the San Antonio Spurs. They just traded this season for De'Aaron Fox, who's a point guard from the Sacramento Kings. They drafted a point guard last year who just won Rookie of the Year in Stephon Castle. I don't know if they need another point guard on that team that might hinder the development of some of the other young guys that they have. They could look to trade out of that pick. They definitely need more shooting. I don't know if they would accept a package of the seventh overall pick and CJ McCollum. You might need to sweeten that pot a little bit more. But certainly if I was Joe Dumars and the Pelicans, that's the team that I would be calling today. But they're certainly going to be looking to be active and involved. I think what this draft definitely did is kind of create a little bit more chaos in the NBA, potentially changing multiple rosters. You have Giannis Antetokounmpo out of Milwaukee, who's one of the best players in the league, and there's rumors that he's maybe going to request a trade. Certainly the Dallas Mavericks would be interested. Certainly the San Antonio Spurs would be interested in him as well. But the Pelicans, because of the Jrue Holiday trade from a couple of years ago, kind of control the Milwaukee Bucks' future first-round picks. So if the Milwaukee Bucks are going to be bad, they want their own first-round picks. Otherwise, there's no point in being bad because you don't even reap the benefits of it. That means the Pelicans are likely going to be involved in any sort of trade for the former league MVP. And that means they could be in position to move up in the draft because of it.
Tim brings up a point that Steph Curry was the seventh overall pick, which he was, but I don't know what the draft class was like this year. And it also goes to talent evaluation by the Pelicans. Tell me about the history of that, and is anything going to be different this year?
Yeah, you know, I think given that it's a deeper draft, some years like last year, you really look at the top one or two guys, and those are the guys that you say, like, these are going to be good NBA players. There's other drafts where that can go down to 14 or even in the 20s, and I think this is one of those years. So there's players that they can get that can be just impactful players right away. And we've seen the draft. Usually you're drafting all-star players in the top five, but as long as you're in that top 10, you have a very good chance of that pick really working out to being someone who contributes to winning at a very high level. Look, the Pelicans have a number of different directions that they can go in. We mentioned the point guard in Jeremiah Fears, a wing in Konkanipel, but they need to improve their big men, their centers. There's Derek Queen, who can be a stretch five, something we haven't seen Zion Williamson play with at the NBA level. There's a taller point guard in Kasparis Jakachonis out of Illinois. There's any direction that they can go. They could even go with a guy like Trey Johnson, who's really kind of a more Kobe Bryant-like scorer out of Texas. It gives the Pelicans kind of more options available than they would have had otherwise. So I still think they're in a good position, even if the night was ultimately disappointing.
How optimistic are you that the Pelicans are significantly better next year than they were this year?
You know, I'm not there yet. It might depend on the other moves that they make this offseason and as we kind of see how the scouting process is going with this NBA draft. You know, 2 years ago, they won 49 games. They made it into the playoffs through the play-in tournament. And ultimately, that season, they looked pretty good. And then they made the big move to trade for DeJounte Murray last offseason. And then he was hurt all year. And unfortunately, he tore his ACL in January, which is likely going to keep him out until sometime probably January, February of 2026. That type of injury to your starting point guard, the guy that kind of organizes your team, organizes your offense, and is also a competitor on defense, is going to hurt them. There's just no getting around that. And for someone making $30-plus million to not have him play the first couple months of the season is the type of thing that unfortunately can derail your start to the year. So I'm not convinced the Pelicans are going to be better, significantly better than they were 2 years ago. I'm going to throw last season out with all of the injuries that they suffered that, frankly, it just almost seems like they can't go through that many injuries again. And so they'll be better than they were last year. But if you compare them to the playoffs 2 years ago, I don't think they're there just yet. They need to sort the point guard situation out. They really need to see if they can upgrade the starting center position. If they can do both of those things, this is a team that has a lot of talent. We saw Zion Williamson play the best basketball of his career down the stretch last season before they shut him down, you know, for injuries to tank and try and improve the draft lottery odds here. Zion, when he plays like that, active on the defensive side of the ball too, that's a guy that's a top 10 player in the NBA, and that will take you pretty far.
All right, so reach underneath your bed and grab that mahogany case. We all know what it looks like. It's that deep brown mahogany, and you open it up, and there inside is the purple velvet and the foam covering, protecting the crystal ball that's been handed down from generations in the Madison family. Go ahead and take that ball out, look into it, and tell me, Jake Madison, next year, Tuesday, May 13th, 2026, what are we talking about with the Pelicans? What's the story?
Yeah, I think we're going to look at a team that made the postseason. I think you can see them getting in through the play-in tournament again. I don't think they'd get out of the first round, but I think just simply kind of bouncing back from the disaster that was last year will feel like progress to this team. Add in a year of development for whoever they draft with the 7th overall pick. You know, they'll be able to kind of remake the roster a little bit, whether it's this offseason or during the season up to the trade deadline. I think you're going to feel pretty optimistic about the progression of this team and the direction of the team in the future.
What are we saying about Zion?
I think he's still on the team. I think the fact that they had him representing the Pelicans on the stage during the lottery show last night sends a clear message that we're building around this kind of guy. Joe Dumars strikes me as a no-nonsense type of person, and he's definitely had a couple conversations with Zion Williamson at this point in time about getting Zion to kind of buy in more, be more of just the professional that you need him to be, whether it's taking care of his body, trying to minimize off-court distractions, let's call it. I don't think he would have been up there if Joe Dumars didn't believe in him, and this is why they brought Dumars in to replace David Griffin. So I think you're going to see Zion Williamson on the team going forward.
Before you go, tell me a little bit about Locked On Pelicans.
We're there Monday through Friday breaking down everything about this Pelicans team. We're going to be doing a lot of draft scouting. We're going to be covering all the prospects people want to know about, so you can get it wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube as well.
Thank you, Jake. Appreciate your time as always. Jake Madison, host of Locked On Pelicans. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, but we'll see what goes on with the Pelicans. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books. We talk about mental health, and we thought we'd look into what Mark Zuckerberg said about AI filling the need for human friends. And I would ask you to text me on the Oakland Jeweler text me line at 504-260-1870. Do you think you could ever get the same fulfillment from artificial intelligence when it comes to a friend as you could from real people? Because it just seems, I couldn't suspend my disbelief, and I said this earlier, it'd be the same as
Taco to go, taco to, and a big cube, taco to go, quick trip taco just $2.99, comes with a big cube, this deal so fine, brisket breakfast, so much to choose, for $2.99, you really can't taco, lose, taco, taco to go.
As you know, I guess when it comes to love, seeing a professional, and I'll phrase it that delicately, because you know it's not real, right? So I don't understand where the enjoyment or satisfaction would come from, but text me, let me know, 504-260-1870, Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. All righty, 9:29. We're getting ready to talk to Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical licensed neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We're talking about loneliness and meaningful connections because Mark Zuckerberg getting some attention when he said that the average person has three friends, and that AI could be a substitute for genuine connection and genuine friendship. And with that, we're joined now by Dr. Judy Ho. How you doing, Dr. Judy? Hey, Doc.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Thank you. Tell me about, Perfect. How are you, first of all?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Tell me about, before we get to artificial intelligence and loneliness and so forth, how big of a problem is loneliness, and how important is it to have meaningful connections in your life?
Well, loneliness is a huge problem. We're actually in what we would call a loneliness epidemic of sorts, and there's a lot of recent emerging data that says that over half of adults feel lonely some of the time or most of the time. And obviously, this has actually nothing to do with how many people maybe you live with or interact with, because loneliness is a perceptive experience, right? So it's how you experience whether or not you feel connected, that you feel part of something meaningful and part of a community. And we know that loneliness, especially chronic loneliness, not just sort of incidental ones that go back and forth, and sometimes you actually feel great, but if you constantly feel lonely, we know that that leads to many negative mental health and physical health effects, including increased depression and anxiety, as well as increased risk of cardiovascular disease, even premature death.
This may sound crazy, but how would you define chronic loneliness?
It's a good question. I would say that if most of the time, let's say 70 to 80% of the time, you just feel as if you're adrift, like there's maybe no one caring for you, that there's no meaningful connection to something bigger than yourself, something other than yourself. And then I think the biggest subjective experience I hear from my patients, as well as people who I just talked to about loneliness, is that they just feel like no one understands them, like nobody's going through what I'm going through, or that I can't talk to anybody about what I'm going through.
When it comes to professional help as opposed to confiding in a friend, I know some people have problems with therapy, no disrespect to you at all, but that they say, well, all I'm doing is paying somebody to listen to my problems. And I was watching, coincidentally enough, as I was working out the other night, this HBO series In Treatment, I think is the name of it. And I was seeing where they were just, I guess, identifying some problems or surfacing some issues. Talk about the difference for people that don't believe in therapy or think that they're just paying somebody to listen to their problems, how it's not that and it's different.
Yeah, I mean, of course, loneliness can be at least partially mitigated if you have friends that you really trust that you can talk to. But the whole point of having a professional is to learn, hopefully, more about yourself, develop more insight, which a professional can help you with more so than your friends most of the time, and also to teach you scientific coping techniques, because really what it's all about is building resilience, right? Life is going to come with challenges. No one's going to have a completely smooth experience in life. That's not really what we signed up for, and it's not reality. But when you work with a professional, they can actually give you ways to cope when you have difficulty. I feel like sometimes when we talk to our friends, not all the time, but a lot of the times it can feel a little bit like an echo chamber. You're kind of just riling yourself up even more sometimes, even when your friends agree with you about your suffering, because you're like, yeah, I should be suffering. I should be upset. But then what's the solution? And then I think the other piece of it is, obviously, you can wear down your friends if you're always using them as your therapist. And then I would also say that a lot of times you feel great after you blow off some steam with your friends, but then the feeling comes right back, right? You didn't solve any problems. So it's a temporary feeling of, ah, that was a nice release. But then, you know, the problems are still there. You haven't really found a way to manage them. And so that's really what professional therapy can do to help people.
Can you proactively help somebody else who is lonely, or is it up to them?
I do think that it has to be up to them to some degree. Although, as a friend, of course, you can take it upon yourself to check in with somebody. I think that sometimes we forget the power of that. I mean, just sending a text, picking up the phone and making a quick phone call on your lunch break or when you're driving home, and just calling someone to let them know that you're thinking of them and just wanted to know what they were up to. It really takes so little from us, but it helps the person who's feeling lonely. And also generally when we help others, it helps us feel better too. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely more benefits than just one.
So does it come down to actually thinking that somebody gives a, you know, what about you?
It does. Mm-hmm. I think that we all want to feel cared for, accepted. You and I have talked about this, Tommy, that human beings are social beings. That's how we're designed. You can't really fight against that. Even people who say, I'm a loner, you still need other humans to survive. You don't need 1,000, right? It's really about the quality of the relationship. So that early statistic that you mentioned about Mark Zuckerberg saying on average, people only have 3 friends or so. That's not necessarily a bad thing if all 3 of those relationships are quality, right? So it really just comes down to, do you feel like you have a little clan, a little tribe, a little group of people who you know you can count on, who care about you? And also, if you were in a pinch, these are the people that you could count on to help you to mentally and physically survive. That's really what it comes down to.
Let me take a break. I'm going to pick it up when we come back. I'm getting some texts here. The Oakmont Jeweler text me line's open at 504-260-1870. We're talking about loneliness with our friend Dr. Judy Hoke, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Mark Zuckerberg talking about artificial intelligence. I don't know how, and we'll address that with Dr. Judy when we come back. I guess if you didn't know and thought it was a real person, and maybe the AI-generated response would make you think that somebody cares about you, but if you knew it was AI, well, then I would think the illusion's gone there and it's self-defeating. But we'll talk about that. Any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. I'll pass them along. Somebody texted in and wants to know, what is a realistic expectation of a friend when it comes to loneliness? And I guess they're talking about, how often should the friend check in on them? Are they desperate for attention? These kind of things. 937, 23 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 944, 16 till 10. Quickly back to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, who's spending some time with me, Tommy Tucker, here on WWL as we talk about loneliness and Mark Zuckerberg proposing AI as an answer to that. Dr. Judy, we're touching a nerve here because the text lines are going crazy. Some of the texts are alluding to, what's a realistic expectation when it comes to being a friend and giving somebody enough attention, because everybody has a lot of stuff competing for their own attention, right?
Exactly. And you really can't help other people unless you're in a good place and ready with some emotional reserve to dedicate to somebody else's struggles. And so I know that sometimes we feel guilty, like, oh man, I know this person's going through a really rough time, but I also have my own stuff going on. I think that you have to use your best judgment and also release yourself of that guilt, because if you don't take care of yourself first, you really can't take care of somebody else. Or it'll just build resentment because you're just doing it because you feel guilty or you feel like you have to. I also think that you should, as a friend, know that there's ways to help without putting all of your energy into a issue that someone else is having. So maybe you don't have the bandwidth to sit down with them and talk to them for 2 or 3 hours about it, but you might have the bandwidth to just do a quick check-in call or just a quick text letting them know that you're thinking about them. And so just use your best judgment. Check in with your own emotional reserve first, and also realize that unfortunately, it's their burden to carry more than yours. So even though you can try to help, it's not actually your job to help them to feel better or to solve their problem entirely.
Somebody texted in and said they feel estranged by their children. They never hear from their grown children anymore.
Yes, I know. As a parent, that can be a struggle when they're going through something. When the adults in your life who were once your children, who just relied on you for everything, all of a sudden are kind of flying on their own. They don't need to talk to you so much anymore. I think that in this case, it's important to acknowledge that this is how you're feeling and open the communication line with your adult children. Let them know that you'd like to hear from them from time to time, or even just say, hey, I would love it if we just did a weekly check-in, even if it's just 10 to 15 minutes. And I would really like that to sometimes be initiated by you. But if you don't communicate to them that you want that in your relationship, they can't be expected to know that that's something that you're desiring. So first, I would just say, open the communication line and tell them exactly what it is that you would prefer or want from them. And then secondly, recognize that this is a different phase, that they're not going to rely on you as much. You're not going to be their go-to person possibly at this point in life. And use this opportunity to expand some of your other relationships, perhaps with more extended family members or some friends in your community.
Somebody texted in about optimizing the time they have to be the best friend that they can to somebody that's dealing with loneliness.
Right. I think that if you're trying to optimize your time and investment, the most, I think, meaningful time is still in real life whenever possible. So if this friend is close to you physically and you can get to them with pretty little effort or moderate effort, I would suggest that it's more important that you spend 30 minutes going with them to coffee in the morning than just to text them or just to call them, even though those, of course, are beneficial. But if you want to get the most bang for your buck, if you have limited time, it's in real lifetime as much as possible. And it doesn't have to be long or drawn out. It can, like I said, just be a quick coffee, a walk in the neighborhood. But that really does wonders in terms of making you feel connected to another person. It's just seeing them in person.
People are listening closely because they said they heard Dr. Judy talk about wearing friends out. I have a friend who I feel wears me out. How do you help somebody that's dealing with loneliness? And again, you said, Dr. Judy, you got to take care of yourself first. But how do you balance all of that with being there to support them and helping them? But yet, if you're the person that's lonely and leaning on a friend, you can't wear them out either, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I feel that, you know, we all have limited time. And sometimes if a friend is taking too much from you, you know that's happening because when you see their number pop up on your phone or you see a text from them, you already have a feeling of dread. Like, oh, my gosh, I don't have 2 hours right now to spend on this. So I think in this case, it's very important. Remember, boundaries are loving. Boundaries are not a slap in the face. We all need boundaries. We thrive on boundaries, and we need those types of patterns for us to feel better and to know what's coming. It's important for our brains to have expectations and have patterns and have routines. So in a very loving way, you can tell the friend that's wearing you out that you have, for example, only 15 minutes right now in between the things that you have to do to chat, but that maybe you'd have more time over the weekend and we can have a longer conversation then, right? You can set boundaries like that if you still want to help, but you have to be clear about what they are because, again, we cannot expect that other people can read our minds. And you might be maybe passively, aggressively trying to send some signs, like sounding busy in the background, shuffling papers, but really they're not going to get it until you tell them specifically what you can and cannot do. And so, again, if you have limited time, tell them that. Tell them how much time you have, or just say, I can't talk about this right now. I have a huge deadline today, but over the weekend, perhaps we can grab some coffee, or perhaps we can schedule a time to chat then. That is completely acceptable. And I think your friend, while in the beginning, might struggle a bit with that overall, and in the long run, they will accept that. They will understand it. And it actually will make your relationship better if you can keep that communication clear. And if they don't accept it, then maybe they weren't your friend. And they're what I call an emotional vampire, essentially somebody who just basically robs you of all your energy and time and doesn't give anything back. A true friend will know that a good friendship involves the back and forth, involves compromise, and involves having their needs met as well as yours, and that it's not always going to happen on their time.
Let's talk about AI here. And as I read this, I just think about I followed a golfer. Charlie Hull is a professional golfer, a ladies golfer on Twitter. And after I followed her, I got a direct message. And then I DM'd back and said, is this really Charlie Hull? And they said, no, it's a chatbot, blah, 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 set up to stay with the fans. And at that point, it means absolutely nothing, right? Because it's just artificial and this and that and the other thing. So when it comes to AI combating loneliness, I don't know what's working in the human mind, but if you know it's a machine, at least with me, it means nothing as opposed to maintaining the illusion that it's a real person. Talk about all that, if you would, Dr. Judy, please.
Yeah, it's so interesting because there's actually a couple of proprietary apps that are testing out chatbots for combating exactly this and also helping people who are depressed and anxious, basically having AI chat with them, talk to them, make them feel less lonely. And some people have said, yes, this helps me because obviously chatbots have been optimized now. where they kind of sound conversational, so you could pretend that you're talking to a real person. But I would say that we don't have any evidence yet, and doesn't mean that we won't, but we don't have any strong evidence yet that talking to a chatbot, as much as they can mimic a real conversation with a human being, has those same types of neurochemical effects that we know are beneficial to our mental and physical health and combat loneliness. And I'm talking about that oxytocin bond, that increase in serotonin and dopamine that we feel when we have a meaningful human connection. We don't have any evidence yet that chatbots can actually increase those true biophysical indicators that would show us that this is actually resolving this issue or problem. And but so I'm not saying that it never will, but I just don't think that we have that evidence.
I would think if you didn't know it was a chatbot, but then that oxytocin would kick in.
That's interesting. You know what? No one studied that, but I feel like they need to. So
I'm going to commission you to do that, Dr. Judy.
Right? Yeah, we'll do it together, and then, you know, and then we can publish the results.
Do that. You can examine my head, and you'll find nothing. Thank you, Dr. Judy Ho, clinical licensed forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, 953. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back here on WWL.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Friedman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colone for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.